the sphere and the potential to carry a nuclear drive or some other highly volatile energy source. 10 million kilometers appears to be a safe distance, Mickey, Z replied. Commodore, coordinate with Mickey to assist in the retrieval. This is a priority, Alex replied. And Mickey, while you play it safe, I want to know everything about this sphere, how it was assembled, the energy source, how its transmission was created, what the circuitry is based on. I want to understand as much about the civilization that created it as how and what the probe might be possible of communicating. Understood, Alex, Mickey replied, and dropped off the comm, as did Reiko. Our probe has been hit by some space dust, Alex said, returning to the table. It appears to be inoperable, but we're taking all precautions while we collect and investigate it. Rene, Marie, and Therese looked at the stricken faces of Gino and Katrina and either smiled or chuckled. You didn't expect him to destroy it outright, Rene asked, surprised at the Meridian's reactions. Will you bring the probe here, Alex? Katrina asked. Sure. Mickey has his engineering labs on board the Freedom. Best place to examine it, Alex replied with a deadpan expression. Alex, Therese admonished, narrowing one eye at him. Apologies, Sayers, I was joking. We'll collect the probe remotely and examine it at a distant mining site, Alex replied. You were saying about the Council's new attitude toward armed ships, Gino? I always thought, given enough time, that someday I would become as agile-minded as you, Alex. Now I think I won't live that long, Gino replied, shaking his head. Yes, I want the Harrigan deal to present to the Council. That's only half the challenge, Gino, Maria said, leaning on the table with her forearms. Once you have the ships, you need crew, and most important, you need well-trained senior officers, captains, commodores, and admirals, who have the knowledge and expertise to sail and coordinate your ships in a fight. Gino looked at Alex for guidance. If I were in your boots, Gino, I'd make good use of what's at hand. There's an extensive naval training base at Harrigan where individuals are trained to pilot and service travelers and sting ships. Both are examples of the technology employed in Tridents. Train your people there. We can offer you the expertise of our senior commanders to teach your best naval personnel how to operate squadrons in combat situations, Therese said. And one more critical point, Gino. Never stop the training and testing of your squadrons for readiness, Alex added, staring hard into the leader's eyes. You'll probably not have advance warning of a sphere entering one of your systems, and the odds are against you having stationed a squadron there. That means you'll arrive too late to save the colony that resides there, but if your squadron attacks the sphere, carrying bullet ships without proper readiness, you can say goodbye to your warships and their crews. Chapter 11. Nual Device. The Omnians' guests, Gino, Katrina, Therese, Tomas, and Maria, continued negotiations while their hosts took on the task of capturing the sealess probe. None of the guests were in a hurry to complete the contractual agreements. They were determined to wait and see what the Omnians discovered during their investigation. Mickey prided himself on his hands-on engineering approach, but manipulating the capture and investigation of a probe at a distance of 10 million kilometers needed thinking far outside his normal box. It required Mickey to broadcast an appeal for ideas. "Not a problem, Mickey," Claude Dupuis responded immediately. "Z has a collection of avatars and remotes in a Freedom Bay. I'm sure we can prepare some of them to operate remotely for the probe's investigation. Don't know about collection and transport, though. You'll have to solve that one." "Tell me how you can help with the examination of the device, Claude," Mickey sent. "We've a collection of shadows that you can use," Claude sent in reply. "Their energy beads are too small to last for the length of time you'll need, but you can configure some of the larger specimens with grav shells for their energy supply, and then outfit them with a set of tools. That was easy, Mickey thought, smiling at the collection of individuals Alex had amassed, who came with a plethora of experience, skills, and, oh yes, toys. The mechanics of capture, transport, and dissection weren't the only issues requiring resolution. Mickey also needed a means of collecting the minute observations that Alex required, which meant data collection. "Miriam, I need your help," Mickey sent to the Sade. "With the probe?" Miriam replied. Every Omnian Sade was aware of Alex's request concerning the probe and its subsequent investigation. "Yes, it's Alex's priority. We'll need a team to work with Claude on reconfiguring Z's shadows to investigate the probe. They'll have to be controlled remotely. I still need a concept for remote collection and transport, though." "I will enlist Glenn to help with the method of transport," Miriam sent. "We can use Killian, Bethley, and Trium for the team. Alex has ordered the scout ship to remain in system." "Are the Sades upset about being restricted to the system?" Mickey asked. Only humans who had lived in close association with the freed Sades understood that even though they were digital entities, they had emotional algorithms that required satisfaction. "Alex told the Vivian's crew that he would be ordering every returning scout ship to remain in system. He said, 'We have a target. When we're ready to sail to find the sphere that left the Olasa system, the scout ships will accompany us.'" Glenn chose to co-opt the Vivian to use as the sphere's collection and transport vehicle. The enormous bays of the city ship accommodated the scout ship for its augmentation, although it did require an empty bay. Mickey's engineering team took Glenn's concept and turned it into reality. A small trap box was built and attached to the scout ship's hatch with programmable extension rods to reduce interference in the shell's collection capability. When all was ready, the Vivian and OS prosecutor, captained by Darius Garmata, left orbit and headed for the outer rim of Selous. Killian would control the Vivian remotely from the bridge of the Trident warship. The Sades had estimated that 10 million kilometers should be a safe distance, but it was unknown what sort of alien technology and power lurked inside the device. When the prosecutor came to a stationary position, the controller identified the distance to the probe at 16.43 million kilometers, and Killian glanced at Darius. "Insurance," Darius replied, which Killian translated as that was as near to the probe as the captain was going to get. The scout ship's telemetry was streamed to the warship's controller, which Killian monitored. The Sade eased the Vivian beside the probe. Glenn's design required Mickey's team to mount 4 vid cams at the corners of the box, which allowed Killian to center the probe in the box's opening. The grav-capable scout ship enabled Killian to delicately maneuver the vessel. Mickey had wondered if a tethering process might have been a better way to go, but the Sades had vetoed that idea, saying that the beam's energy might disturb the probe enough to have it execute a fail-safe routine, even though it was incapable of transmitting. Glenn had chosen the trap approach based on Killian's assurance that he could easily slide the sphere into the box. And that was what Killian did. The sphere entered the enclosure without touching a side or the far end of the box. Killian signaled the twin doors of the box to close, trapping the sphere, and the walls of the nanites-coated box closed on the sphere, anchoring it in place. "Well done, Killian," Darius remarked. His warship's controller was transmitting everything, telemetry data, vidcam views, comms, and bridge conversation, to the Freedom, where the action was being closely monitored. Killian slaved the scout ship's controller to that of the prosecutors, allowing Darius to carefully back the warship away, towing the scout ship behind it and maintaining a safe distance. It took 2 anxious days before the Trident was positioned near a moon which held a recently abandoned mining site. Killian released the controller link between the 2 vessels, and guided the scout ship to an area that had been cleared and flattened for the upcoming operation. Once the Vivian was on the surface, the hatch was triggered and slowly lowered. The extension rods that supported the box were capable of cantilevering. This allowed the box to be kept level and prevent the probe from rotating. The box gently touched the moon's surface. The rods released it, and the box was detached from the scout ship's hatch. The Sades aboard the warship began the next stage of the operation. Miriam, Killian, Bethley, and Trium were each linked to separate shadows via the scout ship's controller. The small devices, called shadows, that Z had first created to penetrate an Earther warship, which had masqueraded as an explorer, had a limited comm range. This meant the scout ship must remain on the moon's surface during the investigation of the probe to facilitate communication. This aspect of the operation, exposing the scout ship to possible obliteration, didn't settle well with the Vivian's crew, but they kept their thoughts to themselves. Killian activated the doors of the box. Then the Sades initiated control of the four spider-like shadows. The devices crawled from the vessel across the hatch and dropped to the moon's surface. Ever so carefully, the small but powerful creations hauled the probe from the box. The vidcams mounted on the box were repositioned to maintain a visual for the individuals monitoring the proceedings. The first task was a minute examination of the probe's surface, which every shadow was capable of transmitting. Mickey was hosting a small gathering in his engineering bay where everyone was focused on an incredibly large holovid display. "Looks like a miniature sphere," Tatia commented. "Typical of any intelligent species," Mickey replied. "If a design works, why not keep using it until something better comes along?" "Okay, Mickey, does that mean we can grasp it by the top and bottom, twist the two halves, and get it to open up like the sphere does to disgorge its bullet ships?" Ellie asked. "Not a bad idea," Mickey quipped, giving Ellie a quick grin, before his face took on a flat expression, and he added, "But I don't suggest it." "Council Leader Gino Diamante," Miriam sent, while her shadow continued its close-up scanning, "I'm unable to find details in my recording of your communication with Alex as to how you destroyed the probes that you found and what the results of your actions were." Suddenly, more than one Omnian was berating themselves for not having asked the same question but much earlier. "I'm embarrassed to say, Miriam, that without defensive weapons we resorted to primitive methods," Gino sent. "Which were?" Alex coaxed. "We used mining excavators accompanied by ore loaders to launch rocks at the probes until we demolished them. It was a slow and laborious process. Many times I wished for a single beam-capable fighter or warship," Gino lamented.
"And specifically, Sayre, what happened to the probes?" Miriam prompted.
"There was no active reaction from the probes," Theodore interjected after quickly reviewing the pertinent data. "In every case, the impacts continued to dent and then break the probe into pieces."
"But you never collected the pieces?" Alex asked, wanting to ensure he understood what Gino had said during the conference.
"Sayre," Theodore replied, "the excavators launched continuously. By the time it was observed that the probes were breaking up, there were many more metric tons of rock and pebble headed the probe's way. Eventually, the entire stream of device debris and rubble sailed out of the system. We always located the probes at system's peripheries, and the meridians were careful to direct the streams of ore outward.
Pardon my desire to ensure accuracy in our communication, Theodore," Miriam sent, choosing to ignore discussing the fine details with a human. "How did the probes break apart?"
Theodore pulled the detailed vids recorded from the observing vessels and sent the imagery to Miriam, who studied the probe's demolishment.
"Sayers, the cases of the probes dented, cracked, and sections broke off, exposing the internal systems. In every case, the probe revealed a glow from some unidentified source. The opportunity to study the inside of each probe is limited to a few ticks of time
before the next onslaught of rocks demolished more pieces of the probe and extinguished the light source, Miriam summarized. There were audible sighs of relief from the humans who shared the comlink. Having missed the opportunity to delve deeper into the Meridian's method of removing the probes, it appeared that there had been nothing more to glean. Belatedly, it occurred to Alex that if a warning about a probe's demolishment had been needed, Theodore would have sounded the alarm, which made him wonder why Miriam was questioning Gino and Theodore so closely.
"Miriam," Alex sent in a private comm, "what are you concerned about?"
"A thought has occurred to me, sir. Our enemy is a technologically sophisticated species, much more so than us. Therefore, I asked myself, if I could design a probe to do anything I wanted, what would it be capable of doing?"
"And the answer was?" Alex asked.
"First and foremost, I would have designed my probe to tell the difference between common space events and investigations by intelligent life forms."
"Meaning, when the Meridians resorted to the simplistic approach of rock throwing, your probe would have acquiesced to being demolished rather than give up its secret," Alex replied.
"Precisely, sir. However, if my probe were discovered by a space-faring life form, one probably originating from the system under observation, then..."
"You would detonate your power source, eliminating all trace of your surreptitious observation of the system and those arriving to observe you," Alex finished. "We've already captured and moved the probe, Miriam. Doesn't that negate your theory?"
"Unfortunately, sir, I'm unable to model the new All-Psyche. I can't predict exactly what they might do, but the probability is high that our investigation of the probe will be terminated sooner than later."
Alex trusted and accepted the advice of Sades, especially those who were free and had lived side by side with humans for years. They shared the priority to protect their comrades, humans and Sades, while pursuing the enemy. "Abandon the probe's investigation," Alex ordered, the power of his thoughts striking hard at implants and comms alike. "Sades, freeze the shadows where they are. Killian, lift the Vivian without closing the hatch. Captain Gautama, fast exit." The four Sades cut their links to the shadows. Killian eased the scout ship clear of the probe. He waited to close the hatch after he'd launched the vessel from the moon's surface. Darius applied maximum acceleration with his grav engines in an effort to get his trident as fast and as far away from the device as possible. The blinding light of the probe's detonation speared out and was faithfully recorded by the OS prosecutor's controller. Killian lost his telemetry view from the Vivian as the expanding wave of energy shredded the scout ship. Miriam selected a view of the moon for her broadcast to Mickey's engineering suite, or rather, she selected a view of what was left of the moon. A wave of rock and dust expanded outward, taking a quarter of the dense moon with it. The mining site had been situated on the far side from the enormous planet, protecting it from the force of the blast. As the rocky debris expanded outward, Tatia ordered the Trident captains to employ their warships and travelers to pulverize the moon debris to prevent them from becoming navigation hazards. "Well done, Miriam," Alex sent on open comm.
"Congratulations aren't in order, Alex. I failed to deliver my thoughts in time to protect the Vivian or Z's shadows."
"Those are things, Miriam. There was no loss of life. What you did was think as our enemy might and make observations from that viewpoint. As I said, well done."
"Alex, what happened when you went off our common link?" Mickey asked.
"Miriam postulated that the Nual might have designed their probes to differentiate between natural accidents and intelligent investigations. It dawned on me that if the probe's monitoring system were that sophisticated, it might be trying to determine the optimum time to detonate. When we were operating remotely, the probe might have perceived the unmanned scout ship as an insignificant target, so it decided to wait. However, when we deserted our investigation, it chose to detonate to take out the observation craft." Just how are we supposed to compete with that level of paranoia? Katrina asked.
Stand back and destroy the probes and spheres at a distance. Simple, Tatia announced.
Like she said, Alex said, tossing a hand in Tatia's direction.
Julian contacted the warship's controller. He wanted the telemetry data, which would identify the extent of the expanding energy wave. It was greater than projected, but Julian compensated for the effect of the moon's mass directing the forces outward, away from the gas giant. He transferred the data and calculations to Theodore and various repositories on board the Omnian, New Terran, and Herrikan ships. After a moment of reflection, Alex sent, "Mickey, Julian, and Tatia, I need a means of destroying the probes at a distance without us having to throw rocks. The method must be simple, foolproof, and disposable. Make me 10 of them." An hour after the spectators in the engineering bay had dispersed, Alex received a comm from Bethley.
"Dasada, before we seek advice from Trixie about how we might help Planetside, is there anything that you need done for the ships or station?" Bethley sent.
"Proceed to query Trixie, Bethley, but keep your assignment temporary," Alex sent in reply. "Another scout ship will be released from its construction bay in 13 days. It will be yours, and it will need testing before you accompany the Trident squadron on the hunt."
It didn't surprise Alex when Killian, who he suspected was listening to the exchange, said,
"Dasada, the Vivian might be an unfortunate name for a vessel. Should we choose another?"
"Why do you consider it unfortunate, Killian?" Alex asked. "You, your crew, and your ship led us to a system inhabited by a race who fought a second sphere and shared with us the direction it took when it fled.
But I take your meaning. You might consider something that keeps the original intent but with a slight variation, such as Vivian's Deuce," Alex offered and closed the comm. Killian immediately contacted Julian, the ultimate translator of oblique comments made by Alex.
"Killian, Deuce is an anachronistic name given the number 2 card in Alex's ancient game," Julian replied.
Chapter 12. Probes. Once Admiral Tripping was made aware of the Nual tendency to seed a probe in every system, he insisted that his flagship, the N.T. Jeffrey Orlan, be released from duty. He was determined to be the one to locate the probe in the New Terra system, if it existed.
"Are you demanding to be relieved of duty, Admiral, or are you asking permission?"
"By your tone, Admiral, I'm unsure of the nature of your words," Tatia replied with her ex-major's parade command voice. She would have preferred a private conversation with Tripping via her implant, but New Terrans had yet to adopt the technology. To make matters worse, Tripping started the conversation over the Freedom's bridge speakers. The bridge crew attempted to appear busy at their consoles, but all ears were focused on Tripping's response. Both Tatia and Cordelia were carefully recording the conversation.
"Naturally, this is a request, Admiral. If I sounded a little strident, it's only that I'm worried for my homeworld and the thought of an alien probe circling the outer system," Tripping replied in a conciliatory tone.
"This human is erratic. That makes him dangerous to his people and ours," Cordelia sent to Tatia.
Tatia decided it was better not to respond to Cordelia's comment, not that she disagreed with the Sade.
"Admiral, you and your flagship are temporarily relieved from the agreement. If and when a probe is located and destroyed, you're expected to return your ship to formation."
"Thank you, Admiral," Tripping replied.
He never considered sending one of the other NT Tridents to New Terra. Now that he possessed the means of identifying a probe's signal, he intended to be the one to locate it. To his way of thinking, whoever uncovered the alien device would be a hero in the eyes of the planet's populace, and Tripping fully intended to be that man.
"Admiral Tripping, this is Envoy Maria Gonzalez," Maria said, stressing her title.
She had been in Alex's suite, working with Alex, Julian, Therese, and Gino on the agreement. Alex had set up a call for her in his work study, where she could converse privately with the Admiral.
"Good day, Maria," Tripping replied casually.
"Just so you and I have an understanding, Admiral," Maria said forcefully, "your controller will soon receive a coded message for President Grumley from me. It will be released the moment you enter New Terran space. It will detail the possible existence of an alien probe in the system, the means to locate it, and the danger of approaching it. It will also inform the President that the Omnians are working on a solution to safely eliminate the probe. If a probe is found, I'm advising the President to wait for the arrival of the Omnian remedy."
"That's quite unnecessary, Maria. If I didn't know better, I would think that you didn't trust me to be forthright with our President."
Maria didn't reply, and Tripping cleared his throat before he said, "We'll be breaking formation immediately. If you're intending to send a message, you'd better hurry." Maria ended the comm and smiled. "Idiot," she murmured. Tripping had tried to pressure her, as if she wasn't aware that the N.T. Jeffrey Orlan would cross about two-thirds of the Omnian system before it exited and transited to New Terra. She had days to compose her message and have Julian program the ship's controller to broadcast it when the Trident arrived. "Maria," Julian said, stepping into the work study, "the Jeffrey Orlan is diving below the ecliptic. Admiral Tripping intends to exit our space within 2.35 hours. Cordelia took the liberty of sharing your communications with me. Considering the Admiral's intention, I've composed a message that you would probably wish to send. You have a copy on your reader if you would like to approve it first."
"Send it, Julian," Maria said.
As she walked past the Sage to rejoin the discussion in the salon, she gently patted Julian's cheek and said, "Don't think that because you did me this favor that I'm going to let you get the best of me in these negotiations." "The probability scored so low that it wasn't worthy of consideration," Julian replied with a smile.
"Yes, but you calculated it anyway," Maria replied.
"I did have the time," Julian replied, and he sprouted his infamous negotiations cap, the one he wore at Alex's card games, the open cap with the translucent green visor. Maria's hearty laugh echoed from the study, and the heads of those in the salon turned her way.
"That's a good one, Julian," Maria remarked.
"You had the time," she repeated and laughed again. As opposed to Tripping's choice, Therese accepted the loan of an Omnian Trident to search the Harrigan system. The message that Captain Darius Gamata would deliver to the planet's assembly speaker was that he had made the journey at the request of the President. To wit, he was authorized to conduct a survey of the system's periphery in support of the President's negotiation with Alex Racine of Omnia Ships. It was anticipated that President Lachaud would be returning to Harrigan with a favorable and valuable contract. It was hoped the latter part of the message would keep the Harrigans focused on future prosperity instead of worrying why an Omnian warship was cruising their system. Weeks later, Alex, Julian, and Tatia headed for the Freedom's engineering bay at Mickey's request. They discovered the engineer observing his oversized holovid display surrounded by some of his team, including Miriam.
"Mickey, why is this holovid constantly getting larger than the one on the bridge?" Tatia asked.
"Always upgrading it, Admiral, and we do have much more space in this bay than on the bridge," Mickey explained.
"And engineers need to see details," Alex allowed, although his expression didn't show that he believed that.
"See, Alex understands," Mickey said, feeling exonerated.
"What do you have for us, Mickey?" Alex asked.
"As you requested, Alex, it's your probe destroyer, or as we call it, the Banisher," Mickey replied with a grin.
"Appropriate, Mickey," Tatia said, chuckling. "We are trying to divest ourselves of alien vermin."
Revolving in the holovid display was an odd-looking craft. It was obviously a shell-type vessel, but it appeared to have a small bulb on one end and a larger protrusion on the other.
"Okay, Mickey, which is the bow and which is the stern?" Tatia asked.
"This is the stern, Admiral," Mickey replied, pointing to the end with the greater deformation.
"This little vessel is only 5.5 meters long, and it's grav-driven, as you can see by its smooth hull."
"Only a grav-drive?" Alex queried.
"We didn't see the value of both types of engines," Miriam replied. "Based on the data supplied by Theodore, which is similar to the circumstances of our own probe, the Nual devices inhabit the orbits of the outer planets or asteroid belts. Once our banisher captures a probe, it can accelerate sufficiently to carry the probe safely beyond the system before the power crystals are drained."
Alex nodded his understanding and acceptance of the logic.
"And just how are you supposed to capture this probe?" Tatia asked.
Mickey's face split into another huge grin, and Miriam signaled the holovid display. The bow of the tiny vessel split into an imitation of the clamshell rear ends of the sting ships and tridents. In this case, there were no engines.
"We approach the probe from a system inward position, close slowly on it, and grasp it," Mickey explained, like the proud father introducing his newborn.
"What if the probe detonates on contact?" Tatia asked. Mickey glanced at Alex, wondering if he hadn't understood the requirements of Alex's request.
"We ensure the probe is never within... what, Julian?"
"The original estimate of 10 million kilometers is satisfactory, as long as the probe is not backed by a significant celestial body. In that case, Captain Gamata's insurance distance of 16.5 million kilometers is preferred."
"In other words, we wait until the probe is out in the open," Alex finished.
"What would be your preference, Alex, if the probe is orbiting a gas giant?" Miriam asked.
"When we picked up our probe with the Vivian, it didn't detonate," Alex replied. "I'm hoping we can count on that reaction if we scoop up the probe gently with Mickey's banisher. Speaking of that, Mickey, what if the probe determines that being enclosed is an alien investigation?"
"That's the beauty of this design, Alex. We don't enclose the probe. The Sages postulated that there was a high probability our probe didn't explode when we captured it, because we constructed the Vivian's external box out of plex crystal."
"That's a stretch, Mickey, to say the clear box didn't allow the probe to reach a decision between a natural event and an artificial one," Alex commented.
"If we examine the following events, Alex," Julian said, "our probe was damaged, which meant it couldn't broadcast its data, but obviously it could run its monitoring program. We believe it wasn't until the Shadow's intervention that the probe's decision tree was triggered to conclude the event was artificial. After that, it merely waited until an opportune moment. When the Vivian deserted its immediate vicinity, I would imagine the probe's self-protection program calculated a decreasing opportunity to cause damage, and it detonated."
"You're making these probes sound almost as sinister as the sphere," Tatia commented.
"I would imagine they're similar in nature, Admiral," Julian replied. "Miriam's theories about the probes being a product of a ruthless and technologically superior enemy civilization have done much to reorient the Sage's thinking about the Nual, their vessels, and any of their devices."
Miriam tipped her head in Julian's direction, appreciating the recognition.
"Freedom does wonders for opening up the thought processes to new ideas," Miriam said to Julian.
"Back to your concept, Mickey, that we don't enclose the sphere," Alex requested.
"Miriam, if you would please," Mickey asked.
"Everyone, this is a simulation. It's to scale for the two devices, mind you, of how the process would work."
"The Confederation probes were the same size?" Alex asked Julian privately.
"Identical, Alex," Julian sent in reply.
The group watched the presentation. The banisher approached the probe. Then it slowed, and the bow's clamshell doors opened. Gently, the doors closed on the probe, the tips of the doors barely reaching past the point of its circumference. Then the Banisher accelerated out past the system's periphery, disappearing into the dark.
"All well and good, Mickey, but what if the probe never figures out that this is an artificial intervention?" Tatia asked.
"I can't believe I'm talking as if these probes are sentient," she muttered.
"Admiral, the probes must have some form of artificial intelligence, what is more properly connoted as machine intelligence. It's calculating probabilities based on input and programming, but sentient it's not," Julian said with determination.
"To answer your question, Admiral, look here," Mickey replied.
Miriam reset the holovid display to the moment when the Banisher captured the probe in its clamshell doors. Then the view of the Banisher was transformed to an internal view, the shell disappearing. Inside the slender hull could be seen a shaft with a long, thin drill at its tip. "We wait until the energy from the power crystals falls to 25% as the Banisher speeds out beyond the system. If the probe hasn't detonated, and we'll be far outside the system by then, we start drilling the probe," Mickey said, clapping his hands in delight.
"That'll guarantee to wake up its programming," Tati replied.
"And what if its programming is defunct due to the probe's inoperable state?" Alex asked.
"We keep drilling holes until we hit a power core," Mickey replied.
"Our machine is set to punch through the probe, pull back, move 7 centimeters over, and drill another hole. The Sades calculate that within a maximum of 20 drill points we'll rupture the energy source if it's still active, which they assure me it probably will be, even if the probe appears inactive for every other condition."
"Talk to me about our ship's end of the operation," Tatia said.
"The Banisher is a vessel like any other," Mickey replied. "It has a small controller which a Sade or a ship's officer can direct through the Trident's controller. Once the Banisher is directed toward a probe, which is when you have a safe opening, its programming takes over. You don't have to do anything else."
"And transport?" Tatia asked.
"It can land and launch from a bay," Mickey replied. "The Banisher's controller will follow a simple navigation procedure once the command is given. It's really self-contained in many ways. Alex said to keep it simple."
"I like it, Mickey," Alex said, slapping the engineer Hartley on the back.
"The team," Mickey replied, pointing to Miriam, the engineers, and the techs, "deserves the credit."
A slender Meridian-built tech, who stood next to Alex, held up his hands in protest when Alex eyed him.
"I'm good, sir," he said, hoping not to receive the same indication of praise as had Mickey.
"We need a few to test, Mickey. How soon?" Alex asked.
Some engineers and techs grinned when Mickey nodded to them. They ran to structures resting on the deck and yanked back the covers.
"3 Banishers ready to test," Mickey announced with a flourish.
"I can see I don't keep you busy enough," Alex said, chuckling.
"Julian, target?" Alex asked.
"The first test should be conducted at Harrigan, Alex. Based on Theodore's telemetry analysis and the Confederation's discoveries, a probe will be located in the Hellebore system." To the Sades and others, logic indicated the probe must have been in place for a century or more, before even the Meridians founded the Cetus colony on the planet the Harrigans now called home. The Nual sphere had destroyed the colony, ships, stations and sites within the Hellebore system, when the Meridians inhabited it before moving on. The thought that the Harrigan's home system had continued to be spied on by an alien probe for more than 2 decades after it was resettled gave the humans a chill. Alex signaled Tatia and Julian and left the bay in a hurry, the celebratory noise of the engineering team dying out only after the airlock's hatch closed behind them.
"President Lachaud and Envoy Gonzalez, would you please meet me on the Freedom's Bridge?" Alex sent, while Tatia requested Reiko and her Trident captains to link to Cordelia. Therese slid out of the arms of her partner, Tomas Monti.
"President Lachaud is requested on the bridge," she said.
"Uh-oh," Tomas replied.
"Yes, Alex's sending is accompanied by a little extra implant power. I think I liked it better when he used to call me Therese or his fiery redhead."
"Should I attend?" Tomas asked.
"It wouldn't hurt."
In contrast to Therese's subdued reaction, Maria wore a fierce grin. "It's about time," she muttered, as she hurried to catch a lift about to close that would take her to the city ship's bridge level. She'd been trying to enjoy a relaxing moment in the Grand Park and failing miserably. She was anxious for the Omnians to produce whatever they would use to remove the probes. She had a sinking feeling if she didn't return to New Terra soon with a viable solution, the Admiral might do something foolish.
"The Commodore and Trident captains are on the bridge comm line," Cordelia stated, as Alex, Tatia, and Julian came through the bridge access way. "I've taken the liberty of cueing the imagery from the engineering bay, which you were recently viewing. Miriam believed that was the reason for your hasty exit, and anticipated that you'd wish to communicate to the other world leaders."
"One of these days I will simply change my facial expression to indicate my need, and the Sades will take care of everything for me," Alex joked privately to Julian.
"Or we will worry that you've developed a nervous facial tic and your medical nanites have failed," Julian replied.
"Well done, Captain," Alex said, approaching the holovid, which displayed engineering's banisher. Soon afterwards, Maria Therese and Tomas arrived together. Therese and Tomas were slightly breathless.
"This ship is an exercise in itself," Therese quipped.
"What do you have for us, Alex?" Maria asked, anxious to hear about any progress that Mickey might have made.
"The engineering team's answer to the probes," Alex replied, waving at the holovid display.
"They call it a banisher."
Alex played the animation for the audience. Then he walked them through the same questions and answers exchanged only moments ago with Mickey and his associates.
"When can we have one?" Maria asked.
"Apologies, Maria, but you won't be carrying one to New Terra to deliver to Admiral Tripping," Alex replied, and held up a hand to forestall Maria's retort, which seemed to be on the edge of her lips.
"I need detailed telemetry on how well a banisher works, and I need a captain who I can count on to follow my instructions."
Maria's lips tightened. She knew Alex was right not to trust Admiral Tripping to follow his orders, especially when they came from an Omnian who carried no military rank.
"Admiral, announce your choices for deployment," Alex requested.
"Captain Thompson, you'll accompany Envoy Gonzalez to New Terra. Locate the probe and deploy the banisher. You'll take your launch order from President Grumley," Tatia ordered.
"And need we add, Captain, there's to be no one else involved in your operation?" Alex requested, glancing at Maria, who tipped her head in agreement.
"Your message is clear, Alex," Ellie replied.
"You'll need a Sade, Captain. I'll request Killian go with you," Alex added.
Alex had no sooner said that than Killian was updated by Julian. He bid his comrades farewell and hurried to catch a traveler soon to lift from the planet, which could transfer him to the OS Redemption.
"Captain Gamata, you've already been to the Hellebore system and located its probe," Tatia said.
"Therefore, you'll pick up a banisher and accompany President Lachaud to Harrigan."
"Captain Gamata," Alex said, "once you've determined the safest window of opportunity to deploy your banisher, you'll communicate to the President. She will approve its release. This is to ensure that she's had time to properly inform the Harrigan Assembly."
Julian sent a quick message to Alex, who agreed to add Miriam to the conference.
"Miriam, I'm requesting that you accompany Captain Gamata to the Harrigan system to coordinate the release of the banisher. Captain, Miriam was instrumental in the design and construction of this tool."
"Subject experts are always welcome," Darius replied. "Especially when they come in the shape of a Sade."
"Flatterer," Miriam laughed. Her Sade sound for laughter imitated a pair of songbirds.
Chapter 13.
Homeworlds 1. The OS prosecutor's controller held the telemetry of the Hellebore probe's orbital track from its earlier survey, which enabled Miriam to quickly calculate the optimum point of intersection for the Trident the moment it transited into the system's space. President Lachaud's ship and the Trident had immediately parted ways. Her captain charted a course for Hurricane, and the Trident cut across the ecliptic to intercept the probe, which was crossing behind Hellebore's outermost planet. Therese wasted no time scheduling an extended assembly session. She left her message vague. While she had good news regarding the agreement with Omnia ships, news of the probe and a sharing of the warships to aid in Alex's hunt of the spheres would come as a shock. With Hurricane in a near orbit, Therese made the planet days ahead of the Trident's passage across the system. Landing at Aspero's primary traveler port, Tomas and she took a grav car to the assembly building. She had only made 3 addresses to the body of representatives before now, and they had been mundane. "Members of the assembly," Therese said, opening her address, "I will begin with startling news, which might frighten you, but rest assured I will end with good news. The Omnians have discovered a second sphere. It's not coming our way, and the Omnians intend to hunt it down. During these past months, it was questioned how the Nual located their target systems, and we discovered the answer. Each of our systems appears to have a Nual probe monitoring it. The Meridians have taken drastic steps to destroy theirs, but they were fortunate in their primitive technique of throwing rocks at the devices. When the Omnians attempted to investigate theirs, it detonated. The explosion was massive, but fortunately no one was harmed." "What is being done to locate our probe?" an assemblyman asked. "It's already been found," Therese supplied. "An Omnian warship, a Trident, captained by Darius Gomata, is making its way across the system to intercept it." The mention of the Libran, who had fought with Alex since the beginning, gave the representatives a reason to relax. "Does that mean the Trident will use a beam to destroy it?" an assemblywoman asked. "Negative," Therese replied. "When the Omnian probe detonated, it was being remotely investigated at a pre-existing mining site. The explosion destroyed more than a quarter of a medium-sized moon and created a danger radius of 13.8 million kilometers." "What are the Omnians going to do?" Therese was asked. "Well, Alex put Mickey Brandon, his engineering team, and the Sades on the job to come up with an answer. Mickey calls his solution the Banisher." As Therese hoped, speaking of the irrepressible engineer was guaranteed to produce a high level of confidence in the Omnian invention. Therese activated the assembly's primary holovid and ran the animation for the representatives. "The Omnian's approach will be to catch the probe in the open and snare it, then take it where a detonation can do little harm," Therese said. "When will that happen?" a second assemblywoman asked. "The Omnians will notify me when they're ready, and I will give the order," Therese replied. "In the meantime, I have an agreement for this body to review and ratify. It underpins the dire realization that the Nual have seeded thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of systems with their probes. It's come to our realization that the Nual didn't come from some lone homeworld with an intent to expand via a single sphere which was destroyed. They appear to be a significant civilization with designs on expanding across the galaxy."
"There's no proof of that," Jason Hurricane shouted.
"Ah, the willful, rancorous one raises its ugly head," Therese thought.
"Wasn't it you, Sir Hurricane, who claimed for years that we shouldn't be spending money on military power?"
On Therese's signal, Tomas sent an implant recording of Jason railing during an assembly session on just that subject. It was heard by the entire assembly via their implants, facilitated by Elizabeth, one of the Sades first freed by Alex.
"This is fear-mongering," Jason was heard shouting. "There was one sphere, and that was more than 20 years ago. No one has seen another since, and probably never will."
"Well, Sir Harrigan, the Omnians have proven you wrong," Therese said after the recording played. "We're finding a Nual probe in every system the sphere attacked and in every system that it didn't. Now a second sphere has been discovered."
"President Lachaud, may we proceed with your overview of the agreement?" another assemblyman asked.
"It's quite simple, Sayers. Omnia Ships is willing to lease the technology and plans to allow us to construct our own faux-shell tridents, fighters, and scout ships."
Therese was unable to continue while the majority of representatives broke out in applause. A small contingent, led by Jason, sat with sullen expressions on their faces.
"At what cost?" Jason shouted.
"I'm glad you asked that question, Sir Harrigan, although you might try to modify your volume. I'm only 10 meters from you." The tittering that followed Therese's rebuke had Jason's face competing for color and brightness with her hair.
"We pay what I consider a modest licensing fee for each ship that we construct. The primary codicil is that we must supply half of these ships with crew to support the Omnians in their effort to locate and destroy the spheres."
"For how long?" Jason yelled, but he did make an effort to lower his voice a little.
20 years, Therese replied. "Afterwards, all the ships we construct are ours to deploy as we see fit."
"Can we still produce the tridents and the scout ships with the faux shells?" a third assemblyman asked.
"Negative, sir. After the 20 years, the rights to use the faux shell technique reverts to Omnia ships. Although there is always the possibility that a new agreement with the Omnians can be negotiated by your president at that time, if she's clever."
Therese couldn't resist a broad smile to punctuate her vision of the future. She spotted Bibi Harrigan, the matriarch of the Harrigan clan, who grinned at her from the gallery.
"I will leave this assembly to review the agreement in detail, but I urge you to make a quick decision," Therese continued. "Events are moving quickly, whether we want them to or not, and Harrigan needs to prepare for the dangers that threaten us."
Therese turned to leave, but stopped.
"Before I go, I would leave you with one thought. We did a poor job of welcoming the Confederation Sages to our planet, and because of that, they isolated themselves in an enclave. I was reminded, watching the Sages at Omnia, how effective they are when they're welcomed by humans. Our society needs to take a fresh approach to communicating with the Confederation Sages. They're invaluable if Harrigan wants to have a strong, competitive economic future."
3 days later, Therese received a comm from Captain Gomita. The O.S. prosecutor was in position. Therese and Tomas were sharing a quiet evening with Alex's parents, Duggan and Katie, and Alex's sister, Christy.
"It looks like I'll require some broadcast time tomorrow, Christy. It will be a president's message," Therese said.
During most of Alex's time on Harrigan, a single city, a sparrow, had dominated the planet's landscape. Little Ben, affectionately known as Rainmaker, had pummeled the skies and oceans with ice asteroids to rehydrate the thirsty planet after the plundering of resources by the Nual Sphere. The increase in the planet's rain cycles and storms led to the replenishment of grasses and shrubbery. Then the Harrigans planted wide swaths of trees, whose seeds were slowly spreading the forests. The return of streams and eventually rivers allowed the population to spread out into hundreds of new enclaves. To reach the present population required a media broadcast, and the largest media company with the greatest reach was owned by Christy Racine. What began as a small news channel had steadily grown in size and scope. Now its multi-channel format linked the population for news, entertainment, financial data, and interviews. It was the primary tool employed by Harrigan presidents to communicate critical announcements to not only the planet, but also system-wide, and to Harrigan ships sailing the deep dark.
"Darius was quick to locate our probe," Katie commented.
Perhaps a little too quick, she added, narrowing her eyes at Therese.
Confession time, is it? Therese said, draining her drink and leaning back in the comfortable couch next to Tomas. The nanites underneath her distributed their positions to accommodate her slender stature.
It's okay, Therese, Christie replied. We know the prosecutor's first visit wasn't to survey the system for a new agreement, as you hinted, but to locate the alien probe.
That obvious? Therese asked. I thought it was rather subtle, using the potential contract with Omnia ships to obfuscate the Trident's real purpose.
It was a smart idea, Therese, Duggan replied, laughing. Until anyone with a brain realized that the Trident is an Omnian ship, probably with one or more Sades aboard, and would have access to every scrap of telemetry data on the Hellebore system. The Omnians would have no more need of a survey than I would have need to look down and count my toes to see if I had 10.
Which means that the prosecutor was searching for something that was small and could easily hide. Something designed to be hidden, Christie said.
They have been well hidden, Therese said. Alex and his people had to do a blind search to locate the Omnian probe. It had been damaged, but they had the Sade power to conduct that type of investigation. The Confederation and we have been fortunate, or maybe not, if you think about it.
How so? Duggan prompted.
Apologies, Duggan. Lost my train of thought there. After the Meridians located the initial probe, they were able to identify the signature broadcast. This allows us to find the probes much more easily, providing the device is transmitting. Ours is still broadcasting, still inviting the Nual here.
Katie's hand flew to her mouth. Lowering it, she said, I was about to say that the Nual have already been here, so what value is a probe in our system? But then I realized the naivete of that thought.
The group nodded in commiseration.
Yes, Tomas said, dispirited. I imagine that piece of alien technology is happily reporting the revival of this planet, saying, look, it's green and prospering again. Time to plunder.
Exactly where is the probe, Therese? Christie asked.
It's been circling in the outer asteroid belt, hidden amid millions and millions of metric tons of space, rock, and ice, Therese replied.
You have my permission to launch your device, Captain Gometa, Therese sent over her comlink. The populace has been informed.
I'm acknowledging your permission to launch our banisher at the Nual probe, Madam President, Therese replied formally, and closed the link.
You heard the President, Miriam, Darius said to the Sade, who stood next to him on the bridge. You may launch when ready.
Miriam quirked an eye at Darius. The controller's telemetry registered a distance of 20 million kilometers to the probe.
Extra insurance, Darius explained.
Miriam signaled the crew chief that she was prepared to launch, and she received the crew chief's response acknowledging that he'd cleared the bay. That Miriam could determine that by locating bio-IDs was immaterial. She enjoyed adopting human protocols. They added a bit of uncertainty to her life, which was filled with ordered thought. When the bay doors opened, Miriam slipped the banisher out and pointed it at the probe. She had already transferred the probe's coordinates and trajectory to the device. Then she triggered the banisher's programming, and the tiny vessel launched itself forward. From the bridge, the course of the banisher was tracked and its telemetry recorded. Soon the little ship decelerated and came to a stop, mere meters from the probe. Slowly its jaws opened and it closed the intervening distance. The moment the four leaves of the clamshell closed on the probe, the banisher's telemetry went dead. On board the Trident, the captain, crew, and Sade witnessed the blinding light of the probe's detonation.
It appears, Captain, that Nual technology detects our style of intervention as artificial, Miriam said.
So long as we keep our distance when these things go off, I don't care what they detect, Darius replied. He'd been nervous about this experiment, having just survived a similar affair with the Omnian probe.
"Danger zone for our ships, Miriam?" Darius asked.
12.8 million kilometers, Captain, Miriam replied. She wanted to tease him about his desire for extra insurance, but her senses had registered his heightened biorhythm levels, indicating anxiety. Instead, she asked, "Omnia?"